Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Every time I fly into Chicago at night, I'm amazed by the grid I see out of the portal. Those hundreds of thousands of almost identical lots, 25 by 125 feet, that are made visible by the city's 250,000 odd street lights, block after block, all sprawling westward out of the darkness of Lake Michigan, like a dream of Euclidean order. I'm amazed because it's so unnatural, so not the way we make sense of the places where we live our everyday lives. The grid is the living image of an abstract ideal, that a place can be quantified, cut up, understood, and settled. The truth is very different, especially in a city like Chicago. Places are wild. Their pasts rear up and reveal themselves. Their foundations give way. In all their layered complexity, contradiction, and intractability, places are about as quantifiable as people. A fact Barry Jean Borich makes explicit in her new book, Body Geographic. Borich sets out to map not only the city of Chicago and the other places she and her family have lived, but also to discover the hidden geographies in her own skin, the personal and collective histories, the experiences and desires that make her who she is. The result is a book that's insightful, lyrically beautiful, and uncompromising in its search for a self as rich as the cities in which she lives. Barry Jean Borich, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited to be on your program.
Well, we're looking forward to talking with you about this new book out from the University of Nebraska Press. It's called Body Geographic, and it's a stunning book. It's beautiful, but it's more than beautiful. It's powerful and raw and steely-eyed in the way it moves forward, and I'm looking forward to chatting about it. What I'd like to do right now, though, is just to give some of our listeners a sense of you as an artist and as a person, and maybe some of the background that brought you to this project. Would you be willing to share that with us?
Sure. This project is one that I worked on for quite a few years, and in many ways, I think it's the book that I have wanted to write since I began to write. I started out as a poet. And if I go back into my, when I was writing in my 20s, if I go back to some of my early poems, I find some of the questions that I deal with in Body Geographic that have to do with place and identity and ethnic history and cultural history. I've always been attempting to write about these subjects and have been, I've digressed. My first book was about coming out and getting sober and growing up in the South Side of Chicago, a book called Restoring the Color of Roses that Firebrand published when I was quite young. My second book, My Lesbian Husband, was about living in a long-term lesbian marriage, which is also something that just came to me at a time right before that issue became the huge national issue it is today. But in the back of my mind, there was still this book I wanted to write because I was living in Minnesota. I'd grown up in Chicago. I'd missed Chicago in these unreasonable, constant ways. And I wanted to write about what that is to miss a place and why that was important, even though it felt kind of unsupportable that I kept thinking about Chicago. So that's how I came to writing about this place and about maps and about migration and the topography of the Midwest, the urban Midwest.
So I think one of the first things that I realized as I began entering into the book is that you think about place much differently than we might just by default as we're, you know, negotiating our lives and getting from place to place or something like that. Could you give us a little sense of what place means in terms of this artistic project for you?
Well, place is both actual and metaphorical in this project for me, and that was just something that came to me in the writing, how I think about place. I think about place as both the land itself and also, you know, history, culture, everything that happened in a place. I'm very interested in geographers who interrogate how the meaning of place is like a palimpsest of everything that ever happened there and the people who've moved in and out of a place. So there's that kind of connection to place. But also, as I was writing Body Geographic, which is about identity and the body and how moving to a place changes you and how you change places when you move to them. As I was writing it, some realities of life that had to do with what place meant to me at midlife really interrupted my process. And so place and the middle of America became a metaphor too for what it meant to be in the middle of life and negotiating between place as a source of possibility, as a source of change, and place as just the gritty reality of what places kind of are on a day-to-day level. So those are the two aspects of place that I think intermingle in my work.
Yes, and I think that the answer you gave is very intellectual and very smart, and I would definitely describe the book that way. It's also very gritty and very visceral, and you open with an image of how place and the body intersect that also appears on your website.
You want me to talk about tattoos?
Tattoos, my goodness, yes, and blood, yes, and bone and pain.
Yes, that's the body part of it. There's the body part of it. Yes, I have places tattooed on my body. I have a merged skyline of the city of Chicago and the city of Minneapolis tattooed on my back, and that's what I opened the book with. I opened the book with the story of getting that tattoo. A tattoo I got because of this issue I've had my whole life of moving between Minneapolis and Chicago and how that city became almost one city to me. And so, yes, on the visceral, bloody body level, I got a painful tattoo on my back. It's not painful anymore. It was painful the process of getting the tattoo was painful. And that's the story I entered the book with. Since that time, I also have a map tattooed on my arm. One of the maps that's in the book, and that's the tattoo you saw on my book trailer, which is a tattoo of the map of the meandering Mississippi, which is a map of change and moving shorelines. So,
and just so listeners don't think I'm only interested in learning stories of tattoos. Well, of course I am. How does that become then a window that opens up the book? Because the tattoo in some ways is a kind of signature opening image that sets out the stakes of the book as we go into it.
Well, that's a really interesting question. I guess that the tattoo represents the way I think about place as something that just kind of breaks the skin, breaks the barriers of who you are, that the compulsion to be tattooed. And I don't know, do you have tattoos?
I don't.
Yeah,
scars.
I know there's people who have tattoos. I think everyone I've talked to who has a tattoo or has tattoos has had a similar understanding of what they mean to them. People who don't often think it's nuts, but I understand that. But there's something about getting tattooed that has to do with the desire to understand and to imprint the meaning and the emotional, you know, blood and guts meaning of what matters to you on your body. And so I think that's the motivation for getting this tattoo on my back and getting maps tattooed and other parts of my body. I have plants that are native to places I've been and the place I went to graduate school, et cetera, on my body. There's a way that I've been, I've invited markings on my body to kind of bring to the surface what I want, what I feel like I carry, if that makes sense.
It makes perfect sense. And I think it's a beautiful image for the book, because the book, I want to try to give listeners a picture of how the book is structured and operates, and I'm sure you're going to be able to clarify this, but my initial impression is it's as though it's a compendium of maps and maps underneath maps and maps that overlayer from different figures that appear throughout the scope of the narrator's life. And so you get this dense sense of layering that takes place as the structuring principle of the book.
Right, right. And if you've ever been to like really historic cities like Rome, for instance, and you go to the souvenir shops, they usually have map books that, you know, you turn the pages and you see the city at a different time in history. In Rome, for instance, you can, you know, open the book and see the picture of Rome today, and then then turn the page and see a map of what it was 100 years ago, and turn the page and see what it was 500 years ago. And so that sense of map as palimpsest is very interesting to me, because it feels to me the way our life in places exists. You know, that you have your life now as it is now, but everything that happened before seeps through, you know, comes up from the bottom. And that's one of my interests in maps, and that's what my interests in just the word palimpsest. So that's one of the operative images of both the idea of the book and the form of the book.
Yes, I think it allows you, you know, we often talk about one of the things that we value in a work of literature is its depth. And usually that invokes a psychological model, right? Are you going, you know, beyond the surface truth to something much deeper? And I think this allows you to get at what depth means from a different angle, and to bring in, you know, social and physical history of the places that you lived, as well as the psychological truth that you're trying to get at by mixing those two together.
Right, right. Would you like me to read a little bit from the opening section, since we're talking about it, to give a sense of...
That sounds perfect.
What I mean by maps? Okay. The book as a whole, I see it as a kind of atlas. So each essay in the book is a map, and it's formed as a map. So I have like road maps with insets, and I have palimpsest maps, and I have triptychs, and it opens up with the map legend, and this is the tattoo piece we were talking about. And I'll read from two different sections of this piece, and it's called Legend, My Body as the Middle West. Scale, the measure of one woman's body, equals the distance between two cities. The body... I'm face down on the table as he needles my lower back. The tattoo gun hums and my neck and shoulders clench. Though I can't see him, I feel his presence behind me. The pain maps I consulted told me this tattoo should not hurt as much as it does. I don't remember such sharp pain with the others, the leopard on my shoulder, the amber rose on my ankle, the blossoming branch on my forearm. Yet I'm not crying. I am not moving. I am trying to vanish into this wash, which I do for long pauses that end abruptly. As he works, I can't help but notice how unusual it is for me to be so close to a man. I am a woman who prefers women, have been married to Linnea now for over 2 decades, have not been this intimate with a dude in years. Ordinarily, such proximity to anyone I don't know makes me nervous. I'm not one to get a massage. I warm slowly to new chiropractors and doctors. I was slow to learn the Minnesota hug, though have an easier time hugging women than men. A man leaning over my exposed backside is not typical in my day-to-day. Tattoos are boundary-breaking situations. This new charting across my middle in more than one way remaps me. But the work he's doing hurts. Just as I begin to consider rearing up and slapping the tattoo gun out of his hand, he finally lifts the needle. This rush of absence feels like love. The map. One drunken night when I was newly in love, my then lover and I stood in a public restroom in South Minneapolis, looking into a streaked mirror. I stared at my own face with the devotion of the drunken and whispered to my lover that my eyes, nose, and mouth looked to me like a map. It was the sort of thing my lover liked to talk about, that a woman's face looks like the map of Eastern Europe, she'd say about some stunningly unconventional beauty or other we'd meet in passing, and I must have wished for her to say the same about me. We were young, me only 23, and often drunk or stoned and prone to believe all manner of unlikely things about our lives in our mostly women's new world, the lesbian nation, a floating country with invisible borders that my lover, 9 years older than I, had arrived at first. I suppose I was trying to impress her, trying to get her to see me better, and indeed I was pleased when she nodded and told me she did see it too, my face made from the copper stones of some beautiful old country. Maps within the map. Maps obscure more than they reveal because their flatness is contrary to the layered experience of living. Maps are representational, but life is lived in the body, is dimensional, has voice and history. So every map can't help but contain other maps, areas of detail requiring special attention, even when the insets don't show. The body, my body, is a stacked atlas of memory. If we think the middle of our lives are flat, we mistake surface for substance. The geography. The actual woman's body in the middle of her life is neither map nor archetype. It's both settlement and frontier. I choose now at age 50 to treat the surface of my back as a cartographer's canvas. I stretch out on the tattooing table. My body clutches and shivers. The artist inks a dual skyline, my Chicago in the center, my Minneapolis to either side. The infrastructure of that sharp black ink stings worse than I imagined it could. Linnea squeezes my hand, but again I shoo her away. I came here to pull all my maps to the surface, not just a drunk girl's hallucination this time, but a marking more permanent. Of course it hurts when he maps me in my history.
And that's when we launch into the book?
Mm-hmm.
It's a lovely opening, and it's, I think, that moment of pain and knowledge coming together and reclamation of oneself is a good way to think about what comes. But I'm wondering if you can give us the listeners a sense of what they encounter after that initial introduction as the piece unfolds. It's not a cradle to grave memoir.
No, no. It's quite nonlinear. And it moves around, in several regions, I'd say. One is, has to do with, Chicago city history and Midwestern city history, and what it once meant, what the whole world Midwest meant, you know, when Chicago was a frontier. So that's the kind of historical level. The personal level has two directions. One is the immigration story from my family, which some members of my family were immigrants from Croatia. It's always been a strong ethnic identity in my family. So I tell some of those stories, most of which are speculative because these are people who I never met. And on the other side of that is a lesbian kind of coming out and coming to identity story, and just the world of queer, lesbian, gay, genderqueer, you know, that whole world of new invention and new possibility, which from the start of this project, I was really interested in positing those two stories against each other. The American immigration story, you know, as we've all learned it, and this other kind of American migration story that's, you know, the queer story, which is, you know, as we all know in the debates of today, is seen as this, wrong an anti-American thing in some quarters, but is of course the most American thing of all, because it's about remaking and reinvention. So those are the stories I tell. I still tell lots of sex and drug stories and sexual discovery stories and sexual self-investigation stories. So all to say, yes, there's sex in the book. But I also tell family stories, and I also tell stories of talking to my father about what identity means to him, and what his relationship to his mother means to him, and what jazz means to him, and what it means to make choices different than the choices your parents wanted you to make. That's the story. And if there's an arc, it's not a narrative arc. It's an arc of reckoning, coming to terms with how all of these stories kind of come together in my body.
I think that rings true to my experience of reading it, and I think part of it is it's almost a reclamation in the sense of, well, you know, you had spoken earlier about the fact that you see the book as an atlas, and there's a passage in the book where you talk about countermapping America and the American mm-hmm. body against, and you put this in quotes, you know, the true and accurate atlas
right.
That any woman of your generation is supposed to follow. And so there's a sense of,
right.
of pulling, you know, the American story and the story of the self back onto one's own terms and making sense of what's there for oneself.
Right.
And I found that curious over and against the number of maps that you produce, historical maps that show up in the book, in which America or a part of Europe is completely gendered as a woman, that the map
right,
is
right.
in the shape of a woman. And you see visually that struggle that the book is taking on.
Oh, good. I'm glad that conveys to you, you know, those maps just completely captivated me. And I, you know, this book did not start out in the map form. It started out as just these intersecting forms that had to do with place in the body, place in the body, place in the body. And at one point, I remember going to my writing group and saying, this was very early on, saying, I think I'm going to call my book Geography. And there was a lover of geography in the book group who was like, yeah, go. And we got all excited about that. But as I went on and just this whole thinking about geography, the meaning of the word geography, being writing about place. And then at one point I changed it to autogeographia, you know, so it was almost geography as a woman's body. But the body geographic part came in at this when I realized I was also writing about the crisis of body immortality that comes to most people in the middle of their lives. And when I started to see bodies and maps at the same time, I started to kind of watch for maps that conveyed this image to me. And that's when I got the idea of actually structuring the pieces as maps. And then the idea of actually putting the maps in the book came quite late. My agent, when she read the first version of the book, said, "This is great, but it needs maps." And I'm like, oh, I could put actual maps in there. And so then I started searching for these maps and going to archival sources and was just amazed at what I found, you know, like the map of Europe in the form of a woman's body and those kind of map like Western art pieces like the one of Columbia, trudging across the Midwest, you know, bringing, you know, culture to the plains, supposedly. And I started to really think about how women's bodies have been used in the geographical sense to convey notions of colonialism and oceans of notions of ownership that the women themselves did not possess. You know, the women's bodies were representation of. And so I started to want to reverse that image and put a real woman's body in that map. So that's the, I think, the deep metaphorical interest I had in those maps and why I was so happy to put them in the book.
Yeah, the map made flesh in some ways.
Right.
So one of the things I'd like to bring out, you've mentioned the body and the interest in the self and embodiment. And I think your book is very body affirmative in all the messiness that the body carries, especially the the powerful ending of the book when you end up, with the MRI, and we can get to that in a second, but just placing that in the context of the history of memoir. So I'm just thinking, for instance, of Augustine starting this thing off with the confessions and, mm-hmm. and boy, a body is not a good thing to have.
Right. A body is the thing to renounce, mm-hmm. you know, that's sort of, I mean, you know, the confessions of St. Augustine are often thought about as the first memoir, right? Or at least that's how we talk about it in creative nonfiction classes, even though that's probably, you know, grossly ahistorical. But we like to talk about it that way, you know, to kind of claim the memoir of as this really, really old form. But I wanted to also reverse that idea of the memoir as a redemptive form. You know, there tends to be this canned version of the memoir, or which to me sounds canned, where the body is something that we might write about vividly, as was the case in the confessions. You know, this is how I was, and yeah, well, wow, it was fun, and I want to change, but not yet. To that, you know, being struck by lightning in the middle of your. The middle of your life, being struck by lightning, converting, and then, you know, finding the proper path. I wanted to reverse that and really, really reject the idea of redemption, or reject the idea that life follows that kind of neat arc, and reject the idea that the body is something that should be vanquished, you know. To move the body to the forefront of the end of life, to move the sex-positive body to the forefront of the end of life was very, very important to me. And it was very, very important to me not to apologize for that. I think women often apologize for their bodies and their sexualities. And I wanted to really confront that in this book.
And for me, one of the more powerful chapters in which that occurs is toward the end of the book, when Linnea goes into the hospital. And maybe you could tell us a little bit about that scene. I don't know if we've had a proper introduction of Linnea yet. She figures hugely in the book.
Yeah, Linnea figures hugely in all my books. So it's been Linnea's lot in life to be written about.
And she seems a very good sport about it.
She's a very good sport about it. I'm really lucky. Students are always asking me, what do I do? You know, my husband's really upset, or my lover's really upset that I'm writing about him or her. What do I do? And it's like, you know, all you can do is be gentle. But I'll just tell you that in my case, I've been lucky. Linnea's hit on it has been like, you know what? I signed up to be with a writer, and this is the story I'm living. And she is the first reader of everything I write. So we often argue about things along the way, but she's never told me not to. There's only one thing that she's told me not to write about, which is something that, of course, I won't tell you now, but...
I was going to say, don't put it out on the air then.
No. I actually have a little essay about that, about the thing Linnea told me I can never write about, and how frustrating that was when she said it, because it's something that seemed to me very, very unimportant, and how that made me realize that there's always another story you can tell to get at the idea. But through all that, you know, she has been just a champion of being written about, even when I published My Lesbian Husband. And we could walk into a coffee shop in Minneapolis together, and people would go, "Look, it's the lesbian husband." So she has her whole little fame around that. But she does tend to factor largely in all of my work. And in this book, she factors in as part of the narrative of crisis that happens in our lives. And I don't want to give away some of the storyline of the book, but there is a point where we both simultaneously found ourselves in crises of the body, and there's a map in there that's an actual MRI, or an MRI I'm kind of reinscribing as a map that I use as one of the maps in the book, and where we talk about what that turning point was in our lives. And it was really a turning point that's where I really brought the idea of the city, the Midwestern city, and the body in the middle of life together. that's what that, that's where that image came from, that moment of realizing, wow, we're as close to the end here, if not closer, than we are to the beginning. And how does life feel? And how do we map this kind of part of our lives?
Well, I think that there's, I mean, you talk about the crisis, and I won't give it away either, although I can encourage everyone to go in. And it's not a linear narrative. It's not, and then suddenly this plot point happens. It's very much a journey you co-experience with the narrator, and you immerse yourself in that kind of depth of feeling and experience. But there is a constant tension that you're wanting to bring out between mapping one's actual experience and its complexity and its messiness in the unknowingness that you face, and even trying to lay down the map to make sense of it. And the ideal maps that keep coming back again and again, whether it's in Oz or it's in the Great White City. And I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about that generative tension in the work.
Well, I'm just, I think what you're talking about is the tension between, there's an image that has to do with Chicago in this, that it permeates the book, but it's most prominent in the center of the book. There was there's a name for Chicago, or an aspect of Chicago, is called the White City, that has to do with the Columbian Exposition, which was the World's Fair that happened at the end of the 19th century, where the World's Fair organizers built a fake city in the middle of Chicago. It's on the site where University of Chicago is now. And it was this gleaming, literally white city in the middle of Chicago at the advent of the Industrial Revolution. And so historically, it fascinates me that here's this dream of the perfect city in the middle of this city where, you know, people were literally losing their lives on a daily basis by being part of the machine of what I call the gray city, which is the industrial part of the city, which is the part of the city my family comes from. My family comes from the southeast side of Chicago, which is where all the steel mills were at the height of the steel industry. And so so I had got this idea of, you know, the white city being the real city's dream of itself. That was an image I was trying to figure out what my interest was when I was writing. Why did I keep coming back to this? And I'm not a visual artist at all, but I actually drew a picture where I drew a picture of the city and gave it a little thought bubble and said, you know, the white city is the real city's dream of itself. And that was my breakthrough moment of understanding what it was I was trying to get at. I'll read you a passage from, this is from the piece in the middle of the book. It's called Cities of Possibility. It plays with that image and also tells a little bit of a story. So all cities are really double cities, the city itself and another city, the city of possibility, a projection of the real, the manifestation, part practical, part erotic, of what we wish for in our lives, or what I wish for. Some people I know pine for wild blue open spaces. It's the possible city, the blue glass city, that I remember when I look back to my first year in Minneapolis, walking all night through the streets alone, or with one of my first and most fleeting friends, a young man I waited tables with for a few months. If I couldn't find lesbians in the late night restaurant world, gay men were easy enough to come by. When I did see lesbians, the obvious ones, with short hair and loose-fitting jeans, who came into the pub for a burger, they didn't recognize me because I didn't look like them, couldn't bring myself to shave off my long blonde hair. Waitresses in the early 1980s, even in the young uptown joints, needed to look like girls to have any hopes of making tips. Besides, I never felt androgynous enough to adopt the halfway between boy and girl persona that was still the lesbian uniform in 1981. Gay men and I, on the other hand, had long gravitated toward each other. I would have been a fag hag had I stayed straight. My new friend's name was Scott, spelled with three T's. He's never told me if the final T was his own addition, but I assumed so. I'd changed by then into the kind of girl who wore eclectic thrift shop ensembles and lived in cheap city apartments with bad locks. He was the kind of guy who took money from older men and spent his rent on tickets to Diana Ross concerts. If you had asked me then, I would have said I was in that in any friendship with a pretty gay man like Sally Bowles of Cabaret, a fabulous bad girl with funny clothes, a foul mouth, and a pull toward the night. I would have been happy living in some hovel of a city boarding house with dusty draperies and neighbors in trouble, greeting my friends in a lacy camisole, falling in love with boys who didn't sleep with girls. If I couldn't finally decide to be a lesbian, that would do. Scott and I wandered through the sleepy streets of Minneapolis, still then a place that seemed to empty out at night. Life was not a cabaret here, not for Scott or for me. The silence was so deafening we could have been walking through a tunnel. We strolled down the center of Franklin Avenue and rarely met an oncoming car. Today I would be hard-pressed to find a major thoroughfare of the city so supernaturally quiet. But in those days in Minneapolis there were fewer people, fewer cars, fewer lights. The blue glass of the IDS tower throbbed dimly, but the windows of all the houses and apartments were dark. Earlier that night, drinking wine in Scott's apartment on the west side of the city, he gave me a ripped red wool jacket with a black satin lining and elastic at the cuffs and waistband. He'd worn it the last time he saw Diana Ross in concert. I wore it that night and then for years more until it was threadbare. I still keep it in my closet decades after I've lost track of Scott. The jacket helps fix him in my memory, a tall boy man, his fine hair curling along the nape of his neck, his fingers more befitting a piano player than a waiter, talking about lovers and apartments and Diana. I'm not certain anymore if he showed me some of Diana's moves, that wave of first the shoulders and then the hips as she approached the mic, her arms flung out to her sides, her flat palms spacing out, stopping all comers in the name of love. It may be Diana herself, I remember, as Scott conjured seeing her on the stage, or it may be that Scott showed me with his own arms and hips how she did it. Either way, it was 3 a.m., and while the spotlights were too sporadically spaced to look like spotlights, they still dappled the damp early morning avenue. Scott, me, and the shadow of Miss Diana walked through the night, marking the shadow hours of this little city with our dreams of some bigger, bluer place.
So you write that words are maps, and by the way, that was beautiful, and so that's what this question is going to be about. Words are maps, and maps say more about where we've been than where we actually reside. The prose style of this memoir, as I was reading that, I thought, can she sustain this over 300 pages or odd pages? It's lyric, and it's keen, and it's beautiful without being false. And so I'm curious that as you were working on the style or the aesthetic of the book, what kind of experience were you trying to create for your reader through that stylistic richness?
What kind of experience?
We're trying to capture it. It's not, you know, it's not a memoir in the flat, plain style, you know, speaking kind of everyday truth to an everyday reader. It lifts off.
Well, in truth, I consider my work to be in the regions between essay and memoir. So I'm certainly trying to do that attempt thing, you know, that we tell our students the essay is about, even as I'm, you know, using memory as material. And what I'm trying to experience, the experience I'm trying to create for readers, I would say, I guess it's just immersion. I was very interested in a while in the post-impressionist painters that, you know, Virginia Woolf hung out with, and that idea of that she had of literature creating, you know, impression and experience more so than story. And I've long gravitated toward that modernist idea of art bringing forth, you know, the experience and impression of the world more so than a constructed idea of plot or event, if that makes sense.
It makes perfect sense. I think the ideal experience of a memoir would be what it's like to be the self of the narrator who's narrating, as opposed to receiving the information of the narrator's life and how the narrator felt about it.
Right. I'm very suspicious of any linear rendering of our lives. I always have been. Even my first book, which is probably the most memoir of the things I've written, even that one is nonlinear. And that one I was really thinking about film and editing and the early film experiments where, you know, those, those Russian filmmakers who edited really, really disparate things together in order to kind of create meaning by bringing things that didn't go together. And that was, so I've always been interested in that kind of experience of literature. And like I said, I started out as a poet, so I've never really thought about a story and plot in the way a novelist does. So, but I'm also just, the longer I write nonfiction, the more I'm interested in nonfiction conveying actuality. That's what I tell my students. You know, we have these debates about, you know, the truthiness debates, you know, about whether we can make it up or not. And I think that whole debate really swings on the fact that we're trying to write memory too narratively. And if you try to write like memory as living your narrative, of course you're making things up, because real life is not like that. We do not live that way. We live simultaneously. The past and the present are always on our bodies. And in our bodies, and we live through our memories at every moment. And so that's always been what I felt like my task has been as a nonfiction writer, and what interests me, and why actuality, you know, as a kind of realm to write in, interests me. That's why I love nonfiction writing.
I think that would be a great blurb for the back of the book. Well, let me ask you about so if the linear can falsify our experience by imposing a direct narrative onto experience that's layered and faceted and recursive and is as much about the present as the past.
Right.
We might think about a shape that seems to appear as the governing shape of the book, which is perhaps the circle. So it opens with the scene of a tattoo. It ends with the image of someone being tattooed. The opening is my body is the Middle West, and the closing is almost the closing is the Middle West is my body.
Right.
How tell us a little bit about that structural thing. I don't think you'll give away any crucial plot points.
Yeah, I've always been drawn to the circle as the form of an essay and the form of a book, and I don't know if I have any theoretical arguments for that. I think it just feels beautiful to me. I guess I want to have that sense of completion. I want to have that sense of echoing and return. Maybe that's the part of me that listens to jazz. You know, sometimes I play Miles Davis for my students in order to give them a sense of what it means to both work in a form, but also digress and experiment within that form. And so I'll play that kind of work that, you know, when you hear a theme, you wander from the theme, you come back to the theme, you wander from the theme, you come back to the theme, you really, really, really go into outer space, then you come back to the theme, but then at the end, you repeat the theme, and so then it becomes complete. And I guess that is what a beautiful narrative feels like to me. I'm certain there's a counter argument to that. There's many ways to think about what makes a beautiful and complete thing, but that's my aesthetic.
Oh, I'm not interested in a counter argument at that moment. Well, okay. So this book is coming out. It's just come out. I hope it does wonderfully. It certainly deserves as wide a readership as it can find. So I'm sure you'll be promoting it for a while. Are there any artistic projects that you're currently thinking about, or plans for new pieces besides the one you're not allowed to write? But
there's a couple things I have going. I have another little novella length piece that is looking for a home. It's called Apocalypse Darling. It's about going back to the mill region in the southeast side of Chicago for a wedding on the in-law side of my family, and ask questions about fidelity and forgiveness. It's a very short book. I had tried to coin, I don't know if I'm just playing or if I'm serious, but I've coined a term for it called the Acela, because it's a lyric essay that's novella length, you know, so And it's about 100 pages long, and it's lots of white space. And right now, I have a friend who's a photographer who grew up in the same area as I did, and she's working on some images to go in the book. So it will be a kind of another kind of mixed image and text book that I hope finds a home soon. I also have the beginnings of something that's about, it's hard to really talk too much about what it is yet because it's pretty new, but it has to do with urban, the green city, the idea of sustainability in the city. And I mean that both literally and metaphorically. I've since finishing Body Geographic, I still lived in Minneapolis at the end of Body Geographic, and that's where the book ends. But since that time, I moved back to Chicago to take a new job. And so I'm, again, another circle. I'm back in Chicago again and thinking about this whole idea of, you know, the livable city and, you know, what do we do in cities to make them livable human places? You know, even the environmentalists say that will be kinder to the earth for humans to live closer together in cities and to kind of leave, you know, the wilderness alone. And so how do we figure out how to do that? And I mean that both in the sense of, you know, rooftop gardens and rooftop farms and all that kind of thing, but also how we recreate ourselves in the city, how we find ways to make art and you know, make erotic communities and, you know, live fully in our bodies in urban settings. And the vehicle for that, you know, I guess pun intended, is the bicycle, because I took up urban biking with quite a bit of fervor before I left Minneapolis. And I'm doing a bit of that I'm still getting used to doing in Chicago. Chicago's rougher. The street are rougher. It's not as kind and gentle as Minneapolis. But I'm doing it as well as really thinking about walking and being the flaneuse, you know, the female flaneur who walks and observes and, you know, inhabits the city as an observer. So that's what the book is, but I couldn't tell you much about what that will look like in terms of form yet.
Well, we'll direct our interested listeners to the blog of the same title, Deep Green City, and they can get a sneak preview of how you're working it out.
Yeah, and that's going to be my early ideas.
It seems to be
And then I also have
Please go ahead.
I also have a book in progress about creative nonfiction writing that's kind of half essay, half craft essay, where a piece of it just came out, and there's a new book that's just coming out this month called Bending Genre, where there's a piece in there called Autogeographies. That's where I talk about this whole idea about writing about actuality, and I probably have about a half of a book there that some of it's been published in various places. So that's in progress as well.
It strikes me that one reason that you might have a difficult time just describing the book is not only the fact that it is in process, which is very hard to do, to describe something that's in becoming even as you're working on it.
Right, it may become something else.
Exactly. But you're also interested in thinking outside of traditional genre categories. So you just can't default back. And I think that's what, at least for me, makes you such an exciting writer, is that
you're
just much more interested in seeing what you can create rather than finding a slot for something.
Well, thank you. And I'm really interested in work that geographers and urban planners are doing as well. One of the things I'm really excited about in my new job at DePaul is there's a really strong geography department there, and I've been meeting the geographers, and I'm really looking forward to that conversation, because I think it will bring really exciting new levels to my work.
Well, Barry, we wish you all the best with it, and thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.